This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.
Welcome to the Division 2, Division 3 podcast. We have a very special episode, some pre-bracketology discussion, talking about some big games in D2, D3. As we approach conference tournament time, conference tournaments start this weekend or have already started for a few of the Southern conferences. And we're back as a trio. I'm Matt Kinnear, joined here in the offices by Josh Davey, and Kyle Devitt is up in the north in New Hampshire. Feels good to be back. It feels good to be back, the whole group. It's like Neil Peart coming back to the drum kit after kind of a layover there.
I don't understand that reference, but I was typing Welcome Back, Kinnear as the title of our Google Doc for our notes for this podcast. So, Kyle, how do you feel about having Matty K back in the saddle?
I also do not get that reference, but
I'm assuming it's Pearl Jam.
Neil Peart's the drummer for Rush.
Yeah.
The greatest trio.
My only Rush reference is, what's that movie with Paul Rudd and Jason Segel where they love Rush?
I love you, man.
Yeah. Slapping the bass.
Yeah, that's my life, essentially. Wow, I can't believe neither of you guys. Kyle, I thought you would have at least gotten that
reference. I'm sorry, man. I can't help you.
Well, it's funny because Terry mentioned the other day when I was talking about my weekend, he just looked at me and said, every day you become more of a suburban dad. So, I've aged 20 years over the past
years. Also, your Dogfish Head craft brewed ale hat has paint all over it, like clearly doing some housework over the weekend. So, yeah, you're aging yourself a bit.
Yeah, we need to get through this podcast so Matt Kinnear can get to Home Depot. I don't know if he's going to have time.
Nice little Saturday planned.
Actually, yesterday when I was watching my son, that's what we did. Went to Home Depot. We got some dirt and laid down some sod in the garden. Yeah, so my life is fun.
I don't know if there'll be enough time.
Well, there's a lot of stuff to get into. We're going to talk about the scoreboard first, but then we're going to get into kind of, I don't know how to describe it, our pre-bracketology talk. You know, we're going to sit down and do our D3 bracketology today. There's a lot to look through. You know, the regional rankings came out yesterday, which is why we're recording this a day later, so we could account for the regional rankings and some of those Wednesday night games. We're just going to talk on this podcast about some of the things that we're looking at. How is the bracket constructed? What's the pool A, pool B, pool C bid? You know, what are some of the geographic implications? And then kind of run down some of those key battles for those last spots in the bracket. And we're going to have our full bracketology on InsideTheCross.com before the end of this week. But first, let's get to the scoreboard and a game that is more than a week old at this point, but we just haven't talked about the fact that York beat Salisbury, the number one team in the country, last Wednesday. You know, there's going to be a rematch of that game, very likely in the CAC championship game. But the Spartans, they, you know, again, have knocked down Salisbury. Josh, what's your take on this?
York's defense is so good. They made every single, of all the 9 goals that Salisbury scored, I felt like all of them were really uncomfortable. Like, it was a pass that was made that wasn't in the right spot, right? You know, we talk about, like, quarterbacks throwing the ball in only one place. Like, I don't think the Salisbury players meant to do it. I think they were just bad passes that ended up working out in their favor. So the two things that stuck out to me were, one, were York's defense, their ability to overcome, kind of getting taken to a little bit, the faceoff X. The Billy Sasso kid made it a fight, but Salisbury dominated the faceoff X. So York's defense, just they were all over the place. They were making Salisbury so uncomfortable. You know, Salisbury likes to set picks high and then kind of have 4 guys low and make the defense choose where they're going to slide from. And Salisbury really struggled in the cage at the same time. So Hunter Davis was the guy for the Spartans in this game. He had 4 goals, 2 of which came off of goals where Brandon Warren, the Salisbury goalie, was clearing the ball, came up to the midfield line, and he either picked off the pass or a York teammate picked off the pass, got it to Hunter Davis, and he scored a goal from 30 yards on an empty netter. Salisbury really struggled in the cage. Brandon Warren got pulled in the second half. The TJ Ellis kid went in. He played much better, but they really struggled clearing the ball. And Hunter Davis just, you know, he's kind of that third guy on the York attack that we don't talk about as much. He had some pretty awesome goals where he had a wraparound, like a Lyle Thompson sort of goal. Just really crafty, shifty. I would, you know, one word to describe him, I would just say he's really slick. Had a couple nice feeds as well, and he really put the team on his back. in this game, finding Pfeiffer from behind. On a big one as well. So York's just played a complete game. You can tell they were fired up. You can see Coach Childs on the sideline jumping around, you know, really into it from the first faceoff to the last second of this thing, time winding down. So York just played a more complete game. They really threw Salisbury off of their game, and they look like one of the best teams in the country right now.
You know, it's interesting trying to look at York right now. I can't tell if this York team is better than last year's York team was at this time, or if it's not as good. Or maybe they're just right at the same spot. I don't know. You know, is this York team a little more capable of going on a deep run than last year's team? That defense is just so good. I think the defense, you know, which I stupidly said at the beginning of the year might, you know, have some growing pains because of, you know, some new personnel, particularly a goalie. God, this defense is so good, much better than last year. So I'm curious if that's going to translate into maybe a deeper run in the NCAA tournament. And one of the things we'll discuss with the bracketology talk is what that run is going to look like. You know, York last year was one of those teams that didn't really get rewarded for their season and had a rough, rough passage in the NCAA tournament that they had to deal with.
But they made the best of it, right? They were in the North, but they, you know, they beat Amherst, so they had a good run. Yeah, this is a cool game. I think, you know, if there's one team that we thought was going to be able to beat Salisbury this year, York would have been the one we were all talking about, as Salisbury doesn't play in the Mustang Classic or anything like that. So, and York's only loss in the season right now is to RIT. So they're legit, man. There's no reason to be counting those guys out.
Yeah, not to be, you know, Nostradamus-y, but basically what we predicted on the podcast last week in this game happened. You know, York just was more put together and took it to Salisbury early, and Salisbury had trouble getting back, and that's how the game played out. I mean, you're talking about the defense. Corey Gwynn held to one goal here. That's nuts. That's nuts. That's great team defense. That's not even an individual effort, and that's kind of what I think is powering this York team going into the playoffs.
Key word you just said is very put together, and that's a very apt description of York and what Coach Childs is doing there. It's a team that has a plan. It's able to stick to it. It's able to adapt when it needs to, but it's kind of all consistent and, you know, just very well organized. You know, you don't see a lot of disorganization or kind of undisciplined plays from that team. Moving to Division II, kind of a surprising score from this weekend. You know, not if you look at necessarily just the rankings, but NE10 battle, Adelphi 17, Merrimack 8. These games in the NE10, you know, particularly these, you know, kind of top-tier teams, when you're talking about Adelphi, Merrimack, Lemoyne, you expect overtime games. You expect one- or two-goal games. You don't expect a nine-goal drubbing of the defending champions, Adelphi 17, Merrimack 8. Kyle, you kind of joke before this podcast of, like, how can you explain this game? So I'm going to ask you that. How do you explain this?
I mean, I think if you just the tail of the tape here is that, you know, Merrimack only had four assisted goals. That should kind of tell you everything you need to know, because they're not an ISO team. They are a draw dump team, and that didn't work against Adelphi. And I think the Merrimack defense also struggled. Nicholas Racobuto on Adelphi, four goals, four assists. Ian Kirby, four goals, two assists. You know, last week, Adelphi only had eight individual scorers, and now they have, you know, four guys putting up two goals or more against a strong Merrimack defense. I think if you're looking for other things that happened here, I mean, this could have been worse. Nick Ponte had 17 saves for Merrimack. I just think that Adelphi might have just outrun them. And, you know, we've seen Merrimack get worked at the faceoff X. That's the case here, too. I mean, Adelphi just had a lot of possession and took it to them. I'm still really surprised. But like you said, those top three teams in the NE10, they're beasts. They take points off of each other. And I think it's going to really impact once the rankings come out and the NE10 tournament comes out. You know, how everything shakes out there is definitely going to determine who comes through in the North for D2.
And the thing is, Kyle, like, I would not be shocked to see the exact opposite score in the NE10 tournament. That's just the way that this conference is. You know, they're these teams that on any given, they're just so good that, you know, on any given day, the team that brings it, you know, can have a day like this. It's not like there's one team that's substantially better and they're going to win 10 times out of 10. It's certainly not like that at all in the NE10. What a good conference. Top to bottom, really, it's getting a lot better, or at least top to, you know, the five or six teams into the NE10 is very good lacrosse. And Lemoyne, Adelphi, Merrimack sitting on top of those regional rankings right now in Division II. Continuing with our scoreboard, you know, coming back to this last weekend where Josh, sorry to say, but Washington Lee, a 10-9 overtime win over Lynchburg. And this is a key game. You know, we're going to talk about the bracketology and all the implications there, but what's your initial glance at this game?
Thank you for validating my excuse to talk about Lynchburg by saying it's a key game, which it is. It was just back and forth the entire game. You know, the Hodgson kid who we talked about, who is our mid-season All-American first-team face-off guy, sort of the difference in this game. WNL won 15 face-offs to Lynchburg's 8, but it was 4-3 Lynchburg at halftime. It really was back and forth, you know, like there wasn't a ton of saves. It was a lot of just really good defense and some calls turnovers. I feel like there was a more, you know, like sort of shot clock rolling the ball into the corner because just really good defense was played. I mean, a 10-9 game, you know, WNL in the past has liked to slow it down a little bit and Lynchburg's liked to run a gun a little bit more. It was just about valuing possession. So, you know, at the end of the game, the Generals kind of scored a couple in a row towards the end to go up 7-6. And then Kevin Rogers, our guy, scored a goal with 16 seconds left to send it to OT. And then Hodgson won the faceoff in overtime. And the Ware kid from WNL, Jack Ware, who had 4 goals in the day, he's not one of their top scorers. So that was a big surprise for the Generals. Not a surprise, but a nice little bonus for them. Scored about a minute into the overtime period. So, two really balanced teams. But you're right, there are a ton of implications and ripples from this game in terms of how it affects the NCAA selection committee, where these teams fall. You know, and I don't want to jump too far into that conversation, but, you know, we talked about it a handful of times in this podcast, how a lot of those early games really matter. You know, Lynchburg only has one really big top 20 win, and that's against F&M right now. WNL really doesn't have one. Lynchburg is right now their biggest win. So, and I know we'll get into those NCAA regional rankings. It's reflected in that as well.
And WNL, when you're looking at their losses, man, these are tough. You know, a 7-6 loss at York at the beginning of the year, a 14-13 loss against Denison on February 16th, 13-10 versus Franklin and Marshall, and 14-13 against Gettysburg. So that's, you know, 4 losses against really good teams by a combined, that's 6 goals there.
Yeah, I mean, you think about A.J. Witherell didn't play in that F&M game. So if he plays in that game and they have that F&M win, you know, it validates them a little bit more.
Right. If they have that win, we're not really discussing them in terms of question marks as much as they're a certainty at this
totally.
Point. So those early season games, man, they do matter. That wasn't just lip service. We were playing in February. Kyle, we're going to go up north to you where you were at a game where I was pretty shocked at the final scoreline and just kind of how it transpired. And that's Amherst against Bates. Amherst with just the really lopsided victory against Bates and Coach Lasagna. Kyle, what did you take from this?
I mean, you could say Amherst is back, but they never left. So I don't know. I think they had a rough game earlier in the week and lost to Tufts by 1 goal. And this was just them being upset and coming back and taking it to a Bates team that honestly didn't look ready for the game. Nothing went well for them. You know, Coach Lasagna afterwards was like, I'm sorry you came all the way up to Lewiston, Maine, and we played so badly. I think that it probably was one of their worst games of the year. But at the same time, everything went right for Amherst. You know, they were crushing Bates on loose balls and transition, and they were doing a great job of scoring in all sorts of situations, but especially on breaks. I mean, they were just murdering them on breaks. And that was really the story of the whole game. There were so many great defensive efforts. You know, Tamer Sullivan was on Matt Lasawa and had a great, you know, kind of helicopter check on him once. Lasawa came back and pushed him to the sideline, you know, didn't like that. By the way, Lasawa still finished 2-4 somehow. But yeah, I think the story is everyone played well for Amherst and not that many people played well for Bates.
Kyle, that game is a perfect segue to kind of the postseason discussion part of the podcast. The NESCAC tournament is set after this midweek stretch of games, and number one is Tufts, and they are going to host Trinity this weekend. I'll run through the matchups. Middlebury is at Wesleyan, Colby is at Williams, and Bates is at Amherst. You know, the reason that this is relevant is there was a time this year where people thought that the NESCAC could be a five-bid league to the NCAA tournament. I certainly don't think that's the case anymore, and obviously that was kind of with the, you know, everything had to fall in the right place for that to be a realistic result there for the NESCAC to have five teams. But they're probably going to get four teams, and let's just talk a little bit about how the Division III bracket is constructed if you're not familiar. Obviously, if you're a coach or if you're a longtime D3 fan, this part might seem a little bit mundane to you, but I think it's just important to lay out what the criteria and everything is here. So there's going to be 36 teams picked for the NCAA Division III tournament. And picked isn't the right word. 36 teams who gain entry to the NCAA tournament. 27 of them are Pool A bids, which means they basically won their conference tournament. You know, these are the teams, you know, the USA South is this weekend, and they're going to crown a conference champion. Liberty is coming very quickly. They're going to have their semifinals this weekend. They're going to crown a conference champion, et cetera, et cetera. So you have those teams. Then you have one Pool B bid. This number changes from year to year. It's a ratio that you know, the NCAA looks at from year to year. But this year it's going to be one team that's going to be a Pool B selection. And what this is, it's reserved for teams that are independent. You know, they don't have a conference for whatever reason. Or teams that are part of conferences that don't get an AQ. So emerging conferences that are new, maybe conferences that have not enough members in them to kind of have full membership, things of that nature. The one caveat this year is Cabrini's new conference is a Pool B eligible conference, not a Pool A eligible. So essentially this means that you can kind of sharpie in Cabrini as the team that's going to be the Pool B selection to the NCAA tournament. So that leaves the Pool C bids. And this is where a lot of the intrigue happens around NCAA tournament time. There's eight teams that are going to be selected for Pool C bids. These are essentially teams that don't win their conference but have put together a resume that's worthy of at-large selection. Very similar to, you know, when we watch Selection Sunday and we're talking about who were the bubble teams, whether it's the NCAA basketball tournament, the men's D1 lacrosse tournament, the same thing for the men's D3 tournament. These are those teams that were, you know, did they put up a resume of work that gets them at-large selection? And this is where we get a lot of the stuff that's, you know, we talk about these early season games and, oh, they have this win over a team that's a top 10 win. It happened in February. It still counts as a top 10 win. And a big part of what we use as a guideline for, you know, these are the regional rankings. So the NCAA, the committee puts out these regional rankings. They start doing them week to week. The latest ones came out yesterday, Wednesday, through games that were April 21st. So that's games that are basically through this past weekend. These are the top teams in the region, both region, as of that period. So this is going to be kind of the framework for when we're talking about who are going to get these Pool C bids. I hope that makes sense for everyone.
I think you did a good job.
Awesome. So let's start in the north. You know, and then also we have to consider this is just the teams. It's the best eight overall. So it could be, you know, X amount in the north. It could be X amount in the south. And that's where when you're constructing the physical bracket, some of the considerations of maybe moving a team into different regions in a bracket comes together. And one of the key considerations there is keeping matchups within 500 miles of each other. You know, that's a key number for the NCAA in terms of, you know, what's realistic as a drivable distance and how they kind of construct this bracket. So you look at the North regional rankings, you can basically put in four NESCAC teams as Pool C bids right away. Tufts is number one in the regional rankings. RIT out of the Liberty is number two in the regional rankings. Number three is Wesleyan out of the NESCAC. Number four is Williams out of the NESCAC. And number five is Amherst. This will shuffle up a little bit, you know, as we go through the next few days. But essentially what that just says is, off the bat, one of those teams is going to get the automatic qualifier by winning the NESCAC. And those other four teams, I'm sorry, those other three teams, I keep saying four, I mean three. Those other three teams are going to be Pool C selections. So if you assume that Tufts, the number one seed, wins, which is not a very fair assumption to make, then that would be Wesleyan, Williams, Amherst in the NCAA tournament as Pool C bids right away.
I think it's notable to also say that 6, 7, 8 in the North are Union, RPI, Stevens. Correct me if I'm wrong, Union is in the Liberty League. Mm-hmm. Assuming that RIT wins that, Union is a, you know, would be the number two seed or whatever, so to speak, in the Liberty, that they would get a bid as well, being the number two seed in a very competitive league, followed by RPI and Stevens Tech. Stevens Tech should be assumed that they'll win their conference as well, and RPI is in the what?
RPI is also a Liberty League
Liberty
team.
League, that's what I thought. Okay, so that's where it gets interesting, is how many teams in the Liberty League then get in. And then you compare that to the South and, you know, the rest of the teams that are, you know, the North ranks 15 teams. So, you know, and how those teams compare to the Southern teams.
And Josh, you're already bringing up, like, kind of the key thing here is, you know, we're talking about, oh, man, Union's a really good team. RPI is a really good team. RIT's a really good team. You're looking at one of those teams not going to be in the NCAA tournament because of RIT is going to get the AQ, and I can only imagine one of those teams, especially because you have to think at least two of those teams have to lose in the coming weeks when we come to the conference tournament. So it's not like these teams are going to go undefeated as we move forward. At least one of those teams is going to be on the outside looking in, and those are good, very good lacrosse teams. The South, I think it gets a little more interesting in terms of, you know, who are these bubble teams? Who are these teams that are going to be hoping that they make a run in the conference tournament to either steal an AQ or just put up a final resume that's good enough? When we look at the regional rankings in the South, York and Salisbury are number one and two, both out of the CAA. One of them is going to get the AQ. One of them is going to get the Pool C bid. Cabrini, we already talked about, they're going to win their conference, but they're going to get the Pool B bid. Gettysburg, Denison, Washington Lee, Lynchburg, Ursinus, Franklin Marshall, Dickinson. That's the rest of the regional rankings there in the South. That's the top 10. And all of those teams, it's kind of a mess. Josh, when you're looking at these conference tournaments, when you look at that pool of teams, what's kind of the most interesting storylines in them?
I think that, you know, you're under the assumption that whether Salisbury or York win, the other team is not going to get in. That is a guaranteed Pool C bid. Where it gets interesting is the combination of, you know, how you sort of gauge the North versus the South and that three, like if you're trying to compare, you know, the North or the South. So you assume Williams, Amherst, Wesleyan, and Union. That's four of the eight Pool C bids, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So you have four left in the South. Assuming that Salisbury and York, one of them will lose, obviously, their conference championship. We'll get a fifth one. You have Gettysburg, Denison, and WNL. We could assume that those three will all be AQ bids. You know, Gettysburg might not win the Centennial. I think it's pretty fair to assume Denison will win the NCAC, and then either WNL or Lynchburg will win the ODAC. So you're left with Ursinus, F&M, and Dickinson at that 8, 9, and 10 spot. So it's really going to come down to, you know, that Centennial Conference. If Gettysburg doesn't win and F&M doesn't win, because I think it's pretty fair to assume that those are the two favorites to win the conference tournament, and that the one that does not get in of those two specifically would also get a Pool C bid. If Ursinus or Dickinson were to make a run in the Centennial Conference, would the Centennial get F&M and Gettysburg in there? It's getting really tight as you get to that seventh and eighth spot. So it's just going to be really interesting to see how it comes down and how you value those North versus South sort of matchups. And same thing, if Denison were to lose, you know, OU were to somehow win their conference, you know, Denison would get one of those Pool C bids. So when you're one of those teams on the outskirts right now, you know, or a Lynchburg or Sinus, F&M, not outskirts, but you're probably a first, you know, you like the first four in, first four out in the NCAA basketball tournament, you're either one of those first four in or first two or three in, you really are counting on a Gettysburg to win their conference tournament. You're counting on Bates to not win the NESCAC tournament. You know, you really need the status quo to sort of remain the same for the next few weeks in order to guarantee your spot because, you know, we saw last year F&M was a really good team that got left out as they didn't win their AQ, and Lynchburg ended up getting up in there, and there were a couple other ones. So that status quo and how that changes is really a thing you have to keep an eye on if a team kind of makes a run or surprises some people. But, yeah, it's really hard to gauge right now. You know, it would be really interesting to say and see what those matchups would be. You know, and that 500-mile thing I think is really important too. Are we talking to some coaches over the week, over the weekend? That's the hardest part of this whole thing in terms of matchups and who gets bumped to the north, who gets bumped to the south. You know, York got bumped to the north last year, 2 or 3 years ago. Cabrini got bumped to the north. So you don't really know, and that mileage is such a big to do with it. But my biggest, you know, area of concern, so to speak, would be the Centennial and who wins that and then how many teams get in there, at least speaking for the south specifically.
Yeah, and the thing that's, you know, when you look at that Centennial, Franklin and Marshall, if they flame out and they lose in the first round of that tournament, you know, I think that puts them on the outside bubble in terms of if anything else happens, they're not going to get into the tournament. If anything else that's a little bit peculiar that might steal a spot, you know, F&M is going to be on the outside looking in. So I think they at least need to take care of one round of that tournament and play in the championship game.
And that's the advantage of also playing in a conference as deep as Centennial, because if you play Ursinus or Dickinson, that win as they're ranked higher in, right, if F&M beats Ursinus in the second round or first round, like that, they're the ninth team in those regional rankings. Obviously that win is valued higher than if they were to beat a McDaniel or a Swarthmore, and likewise, like right now F&M's biggest win is Gettysburg. If they don't have that Gettysburg win, their next biggest win, I guess they have beaten WNL too. So F&M's resume is a little more solid than others. But if you look at WNL and Lynchburg specifically, WNL's biggest win on the season right now is Lynchburg, and that happened Saturday. Lynchburg's biggest win right now is F&M. Again, this is all just in terms of those regional rankings that the NCAA put out. So it's going to be really interesting, and these conference tournaments are really going to matter.
Kyle, you know, when we're talking about all this stuff, you know, it's the North versus South, debate and all that stuff is going to kind of come up and which is stronger. Kyle, when you're looking at this, which region is stronger overall?
I mean, I don't think it's biased to say the North is, just because, and, you know, people will grouse about us talking about the NESCAC too much. Let me tell you something. Those top four teams in the NESCAC are real deal Holyfield. Like, they're really good. It's not, it just so happens that they're all in the same conference. I don't think anyone saw Williams coming out of nowhere being one of the best teams in the nation, but here we are. You know, huge victories. They've beaten Amherst. You know, and I think that everyone knows about Tufts and everyone knows about Wesleyan, but, you know, Amherst is an excellent team. Williams is so much better than people realize, and I think people are going to be like, why is Williams here? Because they haven't, you know, not everyone's going to be paying attention to every single conference, but they absolutely deserve it. They have the fourth rank in the South. I think if you just look at records, right, there's way less losses in those top 10 in the North than there is in the South, and that's by virtue of a lot of the South teams taking wins off of each other, right? You know, we were talking about F&M and Lynchburg and Washington Lee. Those teams kind of like blend together, not because they're ampersand teams, but because they, you know, they do take points off of each other. They take the spotlight away from each other. And I think that's something that we're looking at. You know, you're talking about Franklin and Marshall. I think if Franklin and Marshall gets to five losses, like, they're in real trouble. You know, that means they have to win. And I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, Dickinson gets to five losses. They're in real trouble. I think you're absolutely right with teams needing to win their conference to get in down there versus the North, where we've already penciled in, you know, all these NESCAC teams to kind of go in there and bully out the spots. But I think it's deserved, you know, just in terms of the record. The only losses the NESCAC teams really have is against each other. You know, that's a testament to their kind of strength and how they look out versus the rest of the pool that's out there. You know, I mean, RIT, I think, is probably somehow, in some weird way, underrated. But who's their loss to? Who's their loss to?
Amherst.
Amherst, a NESCAC team. So I think right now we're looking at five super strong North teams. And I think the actual probably overall quality of the top 10 is probably better in the South. But if we're just talking top fives, I don't think that you can compare them. I just think the North is better.
For speculation's sake, can we let's like, you know, just for fun, let's assume that the number one seed in each conference right now wins their AQ.
Mm-hmm.
So let's assume Tufts wins the AQ in the NESCAC. Let's assume RIT wins. Let's assume Stevens wins. Let's assume York, Gettysburg, Denison, W&L win. Should we try to speculate what the next eight teams would be, right? So you have Williams, Amherst, Wesleyan, Union. That's four.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start there for the North. You have...
And that's where you get to the... That's the flex point right there.
Right.
You know, those teams, I think, are pretty firm. You get a Bates that if they win two games this coming week in the NESCAC tournament, then either they have dinged another team's record that they replace them from the NESCAC, or they are in themselves, and that's five spots going to the North right there.
And this is where it gets interesting. So let's say that's four, right? So those three, NESCAC and Union. And then you look at the regional rankings for the South. York is an AQ. So you have Salisbury's a five.
Mm-hmm.
Cabrini, Gettysburg, Denison, W&L, Lynchburg are a pool B. I'm sorry, Cabrini's a pool B. And then an AQ goes to Gettysburg, Denison, W&L. You have Lynchburg at a six, Ursinus, F&M. That would be eight. And that's if you split North-South right now today. So the teams getting in would be from the South that were not winning their AQ. It would basically be the top nine seeds in the South and the top eight seeds minus RPI in the North. So you're looking at Tufts, RIT, Wesleyan, Williams, Amherst, Union, Stevens, York, Salisbury, Cabrini, Gettysburg, Denison, W&L, Lynchburg, Ursinus, F&M. But again, these are all just staying at the status quo based on what they're ranked right now. Dickinson could easily beat an F&M or an Ursinus or something like that and switch that up. And that's, again, like, who knows if Hampton Sydney goes on and wins the ODAC or, you know, Haverford makes a run in the Centennial Conference. You know, something weird happens. Denison loses to OWU. So, you know, that's sort of if the status quo remains the same. Based on these rankings, that's how it would shake out. Again, but maybe not, because that's just if it's 4-4. It doesn't have to be four North teams and four South teams. That's not necessarily a hard selling point.
Right. The next thing you'd be looking at is that Liberty League. You know, does, you know, RPI, Union, RIT, which, by the way, Union gave RIT a game last night, a 12-9 RIT victory. RIT had some injuries that had an effect on that game, but that's certainly something to watch if that doesn't go completely RIT, that tournament.
And F&M beat Dickinson 15-13 last night, so another really close game as well.
Right, so right now, you know, I think F&M is in, but I also just, you know, like I started this conversation, Bates has a lot of upward trajectory possible over the next 6 days with, you know, this conference tournament. F&M also has the potential for that, but both teams have the potential just to lose and leave it up to the rest, you know, to chance, to leave it up to the rest of the team.
And it's an interesting dynamic as well, thinking about, like, if you're Lynchburg right now, you want F&M to win out, because that's your best win, and the better F&M is, right, they win their AQ, the higher they are ranked in these regional rankings once we hit, you know, Selection Sunday, the better that win is for you, the better your regional ranking is going to be if that's the win you're sort of hanging your hat on. Whereas a team that's hanging their hat on a win to, you know, Ursinus, if they lose in the first round, you know, it's going to be sort of tough sailing for those guys.
Yeah, I think people are probably looking at, you know, Bates versus Union too. If Bates wins and they go to 10-4 and then Union gets bounced in the first round somehow in their tournament, do you think Bates gets in over Union? because I think Union drops a lot and Bates goes up a fair amount. But I don't think it's fair to have a 10-4 over a 12-2 with the strength of the schedule. And I think, you know, Liberty being basically the second best conference in the North behind the NESCAC is a consideration. But I think that people wouldn't be surprised if Bates, that's how Bates slips in. You know, I don't think they need to win the NESCAC. I don't think
they need to win. I think they need to win in the tournament. They don't need.
Yes, probably. They need one win. Yes, yeah. I agree.
They don't need to win at all.
You think one win does it for them?
I think that's the point of debate, right? I think that it's possible that it does. It just depends on how the committee weighs Union. So you know, and Liberty League.
Bates is the I think this is set, right? The NESCAC tournament is set.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Bates is the 5 seed. They play Amherst. So it's Trinity, the 8 seed at number 1 Tufts, number 7 Middlebury at number 2 Wesleyan, number 6 Colby at number 3 Williams, number 5 Bates at number 4 Amherst. If Bates is to win, right, the 5-4 game, they would then play the winner of they'd probably play Tufts, right?
Right.
As the 5 seed, because when one would play 4, but if 5 wins, 5 would play 1. So, you know, if you're beating Amherst and Tufts, and then you lose to Wesleyan in the championship, like, Bates is in, you're 100% right. Yeah. I don't know if the one win does it, though.
If you beat Amherst and Tufts in a season, you should get in, even if those are your only 2 wins. That should be just a rule that they make for the tournament. But also, I mean, on the flip side, Josh, the Liberty League tournament is also set. So we're going to have clarity on these two. RIT and Union both getting the byes. So, you know, the number 1 and number 2 seed. So they don't have to play this Saturday. But St. Lawrence is going to play Ithaca. Clarkson's going to play RPI. And then those two teams are going to advance to play RIT and Union. And you know, anything can happen. RIT, for as good as they are, you know, are they untouchable? I don't think that's true.
I do.
I kind of do too.
Sorry, I don't think that. The thing is, we've been talking about how great the Liberty League is, right? And I mean, I've written about it. Ken's written about it. But I still think that RIT is the class of the league. Right. The game against Union is as close as anyone's come to beating them from that conference. You know, I think the only other team that I don't think anyone else really has a shot unless it's Union. And it's, that's solely based on the most recent result. Do you know what I mean?
Well, Kyle, it's also based on, you know, Cam Isaac didn't play.
Right.
And if he doesn't play for the rest of the Liberty League tournament, does that make them more vulnerable than they typically are? Obviously, yes, it does whenever you have a really good player who doesn't play. I think, you know, at this time of the year, there's weird stuff. There's injuries. Something could happen. Is it likely? No, not at all. But I think if RIT is kind of muscling through some injuries right now, maybe something weird happens. I don't know. But also, when we get to assembling this bracket, which we're going to do today, there's the geographical concern. And last year, you know, this was, I guess this is always kind of a point of contention or controversy. Obviously, there's limitations to the bracket. It's not always balanced in terms of how many teams from each region. So teams are going to get moved. And, you know, one key follow this kind of stretch here is follow the D3 Lacrosse Twitter account. It's D-I-I-I, D3 Lacrosse. Used to be posted under the same name on the Lax Power forums, is kind of the bracketology expert, someone who tweets out some really good information. But, you know, when we're talking about the geography, is someone going to move to make the bracket more balanced? You know, one of the things that I've heard floated is RIT actually moving into the South, which is a really interesting, you know, kind of proposition. There's teams that typically move in terms of, you know, York had to deal with that with Amherst being in their bracket last year. But you have teams like, you know, Enersinus or Cabrini, you know, as kind of in that mid-Atlantic area where they're certainly on the bubble of, are they a northern team? Are they a southern team? They're a southern team by name, but in terms of this bracket, they might get moved. So that's something we're going to watch, and that 500-mile radius is really one of the keys to that.
I think you'd be surprised at how far 500 miles is. I'm looking it up right now on Google Maps. So, like, the most southern team that we've talked about is Lynchburg. I mean, it's just over 500 miles. So there's really anyone who could be up for grabs for this. Like, there's really no one. Maybe Bates is the one who's not going to go to the South. But, like, anyone is really up for grabs. Rochester, New York is 535 miles from Lynchburg, Virginia. So that's a stretch, you know, but only by 35 miles, you know, by half an hour drive. So, you know, anyone is susceptible to falling under this and having this happen. And who knows whether it's a good thing or bad thing for them. But it's we really don't know until Selection Sunday.
From one thing that, you know, someone posed to me is that, you know, the committee has to have some sort of bracket integrity, though. It wouldn't be right, and just historically, you know, the top two seeds have kind of been untouchable in terms of moving from north to south, south to north whatsoever. So, you know, if we're talking about RIT as a number two seed, maybe that just it doesn't sit right moving the team that's that good out of the bracket. Granted, we had Amherst last year that moved down to the south.
That makes me think Cabrini is a team that could from the south could go north. If there was one team, that makes me feel like it could be them.
Definitely. And, you know, I don't know. There's also like this. I think that they need to be mindful about moving teams too much. You know, one thing is it could disincentivize teams in the South from playing teams in the North, vice versa. There's stuff like the Mustang Classic that, you know, if you don't have these inter-region games, Salisbury, you know, they scheduled basically all Southern teams. They don't have a lot of data on them in terms of, you know, that kind of out-of-region play. They get the one seed. Typically, you know, probably not this year unless they win their conference. So, I don't know. I just don't think that they want to move teams around too much and kind of open this can of worms of, like, how you assemble your schedule and does the integrity of everything really kind of matter in the end when they can just move anyone willy-nilly from region to region. Kyle, going to finish this just looking at the regional rankings for Division II. One thing that, you know, listeners should know as this is the first year of the expanded Division II bracket. You know, they're going to 12 teams. You know, they have expanded a few times over the past few years. It's much needed, this expansion. And what's interesting to me is if you're looking at these regional rankings, which are pretty much true to how the bracket is assembled in Division II, there's not much that's a huge surprise here. But there are a few teams that are kind of on that bubble that will be interesting to watch. In the North, I'm going to tell you the top eight. So the top six are the ones who get selected for the tournament. Lemoyne, Adelphi, Merrimack, so the NE10 trio. Seton Hill, Mercyhurst, Mercy. Those are the top six. And then you get to Pace, also in the NE10. And LIU Post at the eighth spot. LIU Post is a really interesting one. You know, they're a team that, you know, has the capability to beat anyone in the country, and we've seen that this year. They also have a face-off specialist who just got picked for the Premier Lacrosse League. So, and this is their last year in Division II. So interesting to see as they kind of continue along what's going to be, can they get with their conference tournament and some of their games on their schedule, can they get that win that maybe propels them into the top six of these rankings? And, you know, they really do have that opportunity on their schedule. They've got Seton Hill. They're going to play on Saturday, which is, you know, an out-of-conference game, but in region. So that's going to be one that's going to be a game that could propel them into this Division II tournament. You look into the South, Limestone, Belmont Abbey, UIndy, Tampa, which might be a surprise for teams. You know, they have five losses, but two of those losses are out of region, you know, which don't count against you as much. Then there's Queens and Lynn, who are the top six right now, with Mount Olive and Wingate kind of as those two spots right behind there. Kyle, we'll kind of finish with this thought here. You know, it really just shows how the talent has spread out a lot in D2. Certainly, I think that those top few teams are the clear favorites to win this all. But there's been times when it was an 18 bracket and when it was even smaller than before that you looked at some of the South teams that got in the tournament and you just kind of were like, they're not really a serious team that's going to make an impact on this tournament. I look at it now, and all of these teams can, you know, certainly win a game, give someone a test, can certainly play really well and, you know, make it an interesting tournament.
Yeah, I think if you're looking for dark horses, which, you know, I always do, always love the dark horses. I think if you're looking in the South, you know, I don't know if you call UIndy that at the three spot, but I'm pretty sure you call Queens a dark horse at 10-3. They've got some impressive wins. They've put up, you know, they put up a fight against Limestone, you know, who is still somehow the class of the South, despite all these other teams like Belmont Abbey, UIndy, and obviously Tampa coming back into the picture at 11-3 in the region. I don't know. I think Queens is, you got to watch Queens, man. That's not a team that you can take lightly. I think people are probably going to be surprised to see Lynn at the sixth spot, and if they can kind of retain that after their kind of conference tournament here, it's a little surprising. But I think that, you know, Mount Olive and Wingate can get into that spot if Lynn stumbles, or even if Queen stumbles. But I think those top four are really cemented right now as in. I just think that there aren't enough losses or wins left to push them out in the South, you know, and we're talking about Limestone, Belmont Abbey, UIndy, and Tampa. Belmont Abbey is a team that, you know, I've followed pretty closely throughout the season. They're impressive. You know, they put hurts on teams. They play at a good clip. They come at you from all ends of the field. They've got a solid defense. They've got a freshman phenom. They've got a great senior. And, you know, UIndy is a team that's only 4 years old. That's crazy. And they're ranked third in the region. You know, that's a team to respect as well. The North, listen, the North is the North. I think it's crazy that we could have possibly four, if not five, teams from the NE 10 in. That's not right. That's not right. But if that does somehow happen, you know, if Mercyhurst, Mercy, and Seton Hill all drop games, that's a scenario where Pace and LIU post pop in. And then it's a wild finish, and we got to see who can close it out in the NE 10 tournament and in these other conference tournaments.
Yeah, the NE 10 is just something that's just absurd, how the concentration of talent in that one league. But yeah, Saturday, LIU post versus Seton Hill, I think is the game to watch in terms of, you know, what we're talking about with these regional rankings and who's going to kind of get that last spot in the NCAA tournament. You know, could have two teams in the D2 North bracket that will be in their swan song, you know, their final year trying to go out of Division II on top with the national championship. So that'll be something we'll follow. We're going to regroup here today, try to put our first bracketology up there, obviously with a lot of conference tournament play to go and a lot of lacrosse to be played, but it's always a fun exercise. So be on the lookout for that. And we will be back with another Inside Lacrosse Division II, Division III podcast next week. We'll let you know on Twitter if it's going to be our normal Wednesday or if we're going to push it to Thursday again, depending on some of the matchups midweek. But we will definitely see you soon.
This is the Division II, Division III podcast.